I want to invite you to turn to Judges chapter 6, and we're gonna talk about Gideon this morning. But while you're turning there, if I could just fill you in on some things. This has been an interesting week in the life of our community, and so if I could just encourage you to keep praying for those whose homes were impacted by flooding. I also want to thank everyone that's part of our Woodridge family that joined with me in getting your grungies on and going into these homes and cutting out walls and just trying to bless some people in a really difficult time and a difficult season. Thank you for giving your time and your talent to be a blessing to them. Tonight, we're going to be dealing with a question that's come up to me probably about 20 times, I guess, since we started Veritas, and it's about the doctrine of hell and whether or not the doctrine of hell actually makes sense. And a number of you said it's just a doctrine that I struggle with. And I said, that's fine. Then we're going to put it on the table and we're going to discuss it. And so we'll have the coffee flowing at about 6:30. Starting at 7 o'clock, I'm going to start talking. And then after that, we're going to go to your questions about that. And so I invite you to be there. Also, in the coming weeks, you're going to see a little bit of a change here in the church, just in that one of the places that flooded in our community was Kids in Action. Kids in Action is over there at the corner of Woodland Hills and North Park. And the catch was, obviously, they're not able to run their operation because of the damage to their facility. And so I went over, I met with everyone, and then they came over here. We walked through the facility after meeting with a number of inspectors. That was fun. We got the green light for them to come and run their operation out of our church. And so what that means is you're going to see over the next couple of months during the days, starting at 6:30 a.m., we've got kids coming into our church. All the way to 6:30 p.m., we've got kids in our church. But what a great place for kids to be. How about in a church? And so we wouldn't have wished this on them, obviously, but we want to be a blessing to our community, especially in a time of need, and this is one of the ways that we could do this. It meets the needs of those families who work, and they're trying to find a place for their kids. It also meets the needs of the workers that work at Kids in Action because they get to still work. And so if I could just encourage you to be a welcoming presence as you see all the kids running around the church, that's awesome. A couple of them, 100 of them, are going to be running around pretty much every day of the week during the week. And so just welcome them and the teachers and so forth into our church. And we're glad that they're here. I also want to say something else before we jump into Judges 6. I'm thankful this morning for my mom. I'm thankful for her. She was, especially as my dad was working with Union Pacific, he was an engineer and ultimately a chairman for Union Pacific. I mean, a lot of times my dad was on the road and doing what it took to put food in my mouth and clothes on my back. But that was a mutual sacrifice because the sacrifice that my mother was making was a little bit different. She made the choice to stay at home and to be a consistent presence for me and my two much more difficult older brothers. That's recorded, so I can't get away from that one now. But she provided a love and a stability for me that I would not be the same if it weren't for her. And I fast forward to years later to find out the way that my mom and my dad prayed for me and the kind of spouse that would come my way. And as they always said, you know, we tried to impart wisdom to you, but you can only make a decision that's based on what she's presenting to you. And so we're praying that God would bring a young lady into your life sometime that will show her real self to you. And then we're going to trust him and the wisdom that we've imparted to you to make the right decision as to who is your life's partner in life, in life's journey. And I want to say that God has given me a good one. Being a pastor's wife is not normal. It's not normal. One of the things she was saying to me, your phone goes off at the weirdest times of the night. It does. But walking alongside me in this calling in life is not a normal walking alongside. And she has been a strength and an encouragement and a comfort and a presence to me. And so I'm thankful. I'm thankful for you and for what you bring to me and for what you bring to our four girls. And I know that many of you are sitting there thinking of the kind of impact that your mom had on you or that your wife is having in your life. Can I just say this today? Don't let those words go unspoken. They need to be spoken. So thank you to the moms out there, and may God bless you for the work that you're doing. Now I want to talk about Gideon. Are you ready? Gideon, a profile in courage. I'm just kidding. I thought I'd start with what he isn't, right? I stumbled upon this some years ago, but former President Ronald Reagan, there was a reflection that he had when he was later in life, and he was thinking about when he was a kid, and he learned a decision, how important it is to be decisive. He said when he was a kid, he said an aunt had taken him to a shoemaker to have a pair of shoes made for him, and the shoemaker asked a very young Ronald Reagan, do you want a square toe or a round toe? And Ronald Reagan was like, well, I don't know. And so the shoemaker said, well, how about you come back in a couple of days? And a few days later, he hasn't shown up. And so they run into each other as they're out and about. And he says, well, have you decided whether you want a square toe or a rounded toe on those shoes? And Reagan said, well, I still haven't made up my mind. And that's when the shoemaker said, well, okay, that's fine. So what happens is later Reagan receives his shoes. Now, he hasn't actually answered the question yet, do you want a square toe or a round toe? But he receives some shoes, and he finds himself shocked because one shoe had a square toe and the other shoe had a round toe, right? And here's what he said. Now, this again, this is a reflection for him later in life. He said, looking at those shoes every day taught me a lesson. By the way, I'm looking at him wearing those shoes, right? But here's what he said. If you don't make your own decisions, somebody else will make them for you. That was the lesson that he learned. I want you to think about this before we get into Gideon. Because when it comes to Gideon, sometimes what we find is that we're indecisive about things because we have fear. We're just afraid. But when you think of C.S. Lewis, he said, courage is not simply one of the virtues. It is the form of every virtue at its testing point. It is faith at its testing point. It is love at its testing point. It is hope at its testing point. That's what courage actually is. And I want you to bear that in mind as we unpack this chapter today. Let me just jump right in to chapter 6. It says, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. All right, raise your hand if you're surprised by that now. It's like every time you turn around, God delivers them, and then they walk away from God, and they again do what is evil. How about this? We'll make a note when they're not doing evil in the eyes of the Lord. All right, we'll do that. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts and caves and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land, ruined the crops all the way to Gaza, did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts, and it was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. And when the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hands of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them out before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I'm the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you haven't listened to me. All right, so stop for just a second, because we've noticed that God works in ways that we probably don't. Have you figured that out yet in this book? God works in ways that we probably won't. So here, what I find interesting, just going up through the first 10 verses, is the people cry out for God because the Midianite oppression was apparently really intense. I mean, think about it. How else are you going to live if you don't have your crops? They come down and they wipe the crops out. All right, food's gone. Then you think, all right, well, we at least got our animals. No, we're going to take care of them too. And instead of going, all right, what do we have left? They were so oppressive that they eventually say, we've got to go back to God. See that theme in Judges? Here they are again. And so they cry out, do something, basically do something to the Midianites so that this will stop. And he doesn't send himself. He sends a prophet. Now, how many of you at that point would go, all right, totally unimpressed. We cried for you to show up and you send this guy with a sermon, basically. This is not exactly sit down and sermon time. This is whoop the Midianite time. That's what time it is. They want to be delivered by God. God wants to send a sermon through a messenger. Here's how we're like this today. Some came here this morning, by the way. Some of you came here looking for God to help you. Maybe to heal some hurt in your life. Maybe to restore a broken relationship. Maybe to get you a promotion at work. Let's don't kid ourselves. A lot of times we relate with God like he's magic. I love your benefits. And if I show up, maybe there'll be a little something for something going on here. Some of us showed up like that, only to find out that God has other plans for this time. Only to find that out. We're more like the Israelites than we want to admit. Hold on to that thought for just a second. Because we go on in verse 11, and it says, the angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah. I know many of you are reading that going, Oprah, right? But it's Ophrah, and that belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. Here's Gideon. So we already learned something about Gideon in one verse. I mean, usually he's out there threshing wheat, right? But if you look at it, you usually thresh wheat in the open air. And the reason that you thresh wheat in the open air is because the way that you thresh it to get to the fruit of the wheat is you just throw it up in the air, and it's like this great dust will just kind of fill up the space. So you need to be out in the open, right? So that will blow away in the wind. And then what happens is the fruit of the wheat then falls to the ground. You collect it, and off you go. But where is Gideon? Gideon's basically underground. And you think, well, why are you there? One, it points out, it's because he's practical, in a way. He's practical. He's not sitting there going, this is the optimal space that I would like to be threshing. He knows that out in the open air is the better place, but it says he wants to keep this stuff from the Midianites. But the second thing that you already see from Gideon is he's scared of them. He's not just practical, he's also scared. So when you think about it, you've got a guy that's thinking practically, nothing wrong with that, but fear is already in his heart. By the way, probably justifiably so. If these people have been this oppressive, would you be afraid at this point? And my guess is, just thinking about myself this week, yeah, I would probably be scared too. But then verse 12, when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." And that's when Gideon giggled. No, it's not in the text, but you know he had to. Right? Because Gideon knows himself. One, I'm sitting over here already scared to death, and the angel of the Lord is like, "Welcome, mighty warrior." He's like, "That is not me." It seems like a joke. Here's what I think may be going on in verse 12. I believe that God saw what he was about to make out of Gideon. I think that's what God saw. Oh, you're not there yet. I'm telling you what you're going to be by the time I'm done with you. It was time also that Gideon saw it as well. Instead, Gideon asks two questions. Look at verse 13. Mighty warrior. And then Gideon goes, "Pardon me, Lord. But if the Lord is with us, why has all of this happened to us?" All right, so the Israelites have been getting basically curb stomped by the Midianites, right? Now, okay, so if you're really with us, then why have we been getting hammered by these people for so long? There's one question, but did you notice how Gideon gets it completely backwards? He gets it completely wrong. Gideon is basically saying, "Lord, if you're really with us, then why is there all of this calamity? Why are the Midianites oppressing us?" He's saying, "Why have you left us?" when really it was the other way around. The way this whole thing started was, "And you've done evil in my eyes, and you have walked away from me." Well, what happens when we walk away from God? And the answer is you walk away not just from him, but from his blessing. You walk away from his protection. You walk away from his goodness. He gets it exactly the wrong way. But then it goes on to say, so where, and this is the second question, where are all the wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, "Didn't the Lord bring us out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us to Midian." Second question. So the first is, if you're with us, why the oppression? And second, hey, where's all the cool stuff? I mean, those had to be some pretty amazing tricks when you're doing all the miracles for the people in the days of old. I just don't see you doing much for me. This, by the way, is exactly the point when a lot of people walk away from the church. And it's not because people are in the church to worship the Lord. It's that the people are in the church, as I was saying before, if we're not careful, for benefits. And like, I don't see your benefits, I'm out. You don't pony up, I'm out. That's not worship. That isn't worship. Now, in your heart, I'm going to ask you a question. How many of you in your life have ever been tempted to walk away from a relationship with God, not because you were worshiping God, but because you were treating him like that? You don't pony up, I'm out. No different there than most people today. It's absolutely no different there. Why aren't you doing something great like you used to do? And here's God's answer. Look at verse 14. So the Lord turns to him and he says, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. And then he says, asks a question, which is kind of what God does. Am I not sending you? And you go, all right, so why would that be a comfort to anybody? Because in essence, here's basically what God is saying. You want to see awesome? Watch what I'm about to do through you. Did you see the way it began? The Lord turns to him and he says what? Go. Don't just sit there. So spiritually speaking, here's the way that we're a lot like him. You know, think of all the places that God has told us to go. When what we're doing is responding to God by saying something like this, I want to see you do something amazing, but I want to watch the show. I want to watch the show. So if you could kind of let me just sit over here and just watch it, that'd be spades. That's the way, in fact, I would prefer it to be. Well, so is Gideon, so is most of us. So he goes on to say this. Notice second time, he goes, pardon me, my Lord, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family. By the way, pretty good list of excuses right there, right? So he was like, have you looked at my people? We're weak, right? Now, imagine that his people are standing around him right then. Have you looked at the Yahoos, right? But then he looks at himself and he goes, and I'm the weakest of the Yahoos. I mean, exactly how much are you going to get done with a ragtag group like us? This is almost like the Bad News Bears or something, right? And that's the team that you want to send out on the baseball field. I just don't see that this is going to get done. And in verse 16, it says, the Lord answered, I'll be with you. I'm going to be with you. And you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive. And Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you talking to me. Ever responded like that? So he asks a question, he gets an answer, and he goes, all right, now I'm about to start giving some signs. We're going to get some signs here. I'm just going to make sure that it's you. So here's what God does. He has Gideon prepare food, and when he puts it on the table, the angel touches the food with his staff, and then flames shoot up out of the rock and consume the food, cooking it perfectly, no doubt. And then the angel disappears. Gideon, at least for a second, is convinced. He's convinced. But then, and let me just jump to verse 25, that same night the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old, tear down your father's altar to Baal, cut down the Asherah pole beside it, then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering. And so Gideon took 10 of his servants, did as the Lord told him. Pay attention. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. Sorta obedient. Sorta. I want you to think about this. If you look back in verse 25, when he's saying, tear down your father's altar to Baal, cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Here's basically what he's saying. If we're going to start to make changes, it has to begin with you. It starts with you. It starts with your home. You want all this great stuff out of the people that are around you, but your home, you've erected idols in your home and you're worshiping it. It has to go, including the pole that you built it up on. That's the wood, by the way. Burn the whole thing up. Not a remnant left. Everything has to go. And then you go, So the next morning, everybody gets up. He's done this in the middle of the night, and everybody gets up, and they go, what happened to our God? What happened? And then someone says, Gideon did it. Let's kill him. All right. Welcome to life. People don't like change. Have you figured that out? They don't like change. But, and this is verse 31, but Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, are you gonna plead Baal's cause? Who are you fighting for here? You gonna plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him will be put to death by morning. I mean, if Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down the altar. So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name Jerubbaal that day, saying, let Baal contend with him. He gets a new name. So here's what results. If you look in verse 33, the Midianites, they attack Israel. And the angel of the Lord appears again to Gideon, tells him to fight back. It's go time. And Gideon responds with this, I've got one more test to make sure that it's really you. It's go time. Let's do a little test time. One more test. So he puts a fleece on the ground and says, if you're with me in the morning, let the ground around it be dry and let the fleece be wet. Here's God's answer in verse 38. And this is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, and it was a bowl full of water. All right, test, sign, answered, right? Do you see anything here where God is upset with him at this point? Because I don't. I think that what you do see is that Gideon is needing some reassurance, and he just keeps putting things out in front of God. And here's the thing, it wasn't enough. It's almost like it's never enough. This is part of the problem. So what happens is he says, let's reverse the test just to make sure that God's getting this right. In the next morning, how about the fleece be dry and then the ground around it will be wet, and that will be a real miracle. And then I'll know that God has actually spoken. And in verse 40, notice what it says. That night, God did it. God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All of the ground was covered with dew. So with that story in mind, you sit there and you think, What do we take home from a guy like Gideon? What's the story? What are we supposed to learn from this guy? I want you to write just a few things down this morning. And here's the first. When God gives direction for your life, he doesn't start with you being a finished product. Did you hear what I said? When God gives direction for your life, he does not start with you being a finished product. He usually starts with what the process can make out of you. That's usually where he starts. So like Gideon, the question is whether or not we will, one, believe God. Are we actually going to believe him? And then second, are we actually going to follow him? And following him, when you think about it, it's important. Following him is important because, and this is the second point, we are how God usually works to bring change in the world. We are it. We are his plan. There is something that happens to us when we are following what he tells us to do. And part of what the effect that happens in us is we become mature, deeper, and more entrenched in our faith. That doesn't happen in the abstract. That happens in the concrete. That happens in the thick of life. Not sitting there just wanting greatness, but actually accomplishing something. Because as God has said all along, I'm with you. What else are you looking for, Gideon? Well, know what he says to me this week? I'm with you. What else are you looking for, Jeremy? But he's looking at you. I'm with you. What else are you looking for? Some of us throw out fleeces. Think about this. Some of us will throw out fleeces when God... Have you noticed that your life might come in seasons? That there are times where God works in a specific way in your life, and it's like, okay, thank you for doing that. Now it's time for something else. Have you ever been there? Because I have. I mean, you got to understand, I started in ministry as a college pastor, then to become an associate pastor, then to become a senior pastor. There are times where there's a season of ministry that's real ministry that's also preparing ground for something else that God wants to do through me or through you. And he says, hey, Jeremy, this season is coming to an end. At that point, guess what? I have a couple of options, and they're the same options that you've got. I can look at somebody like Gideon, and I could go, okay, I'm going to throw a fleece out, right? Maybe what it is that I'm looking for is a little bit of assurance, making sure that it's the voice of God, because here's the very thing that I could do. You can, in your own mind, you can sit there and think, yeah, I'm a lot like Jeremy in this. I can look at the fact that I can look at everything that I've accomplished to this point and say, you know what? I actually want to enjoy the benefits of the work that I've poured in, and I just want to stay where I'm at. That's one possibility. I could have looked, in North Carolina, if before I came here, I'm telling you I did this. This isn't my best moment. This is my honest moment. I'm sitting there going, I'm doing well as a professor. The church is doing really well. And now you want me to leave? Let's go with a no. I think I would like to enjoy the work that I've poured into the work. I want to get the benefits of that. Welcome to my head. I'm just letting you into it a little bit. So I'm just saying, before you think I'm beating up on Gideon, I'm letting you know, Gideon is a lot like me. A lot like me. Probably, to be honest, a lot like you. We are how God usually works to bring change into the world. This is why God says, hey, Gideon, go. Go. Do you remember Gideon's quip? God, why don't you do something awesome, like the things that you used to do in the past? And I'm sitting there going, hey, Gideon, that required a Moses, man. That required a Joshua. That required an Abraham. You get it? Gideon was focusing on the wrong things. He wasn't even looking at the people that God used in a mighty way. He's like, just do mighty stuff. He usually uses us to bring change. So here's God's answer. I'm not here just to change your circumstances. I'm here to change you. I'm not here just to change your circumstances. I'm here to change you. Here's a post that I saw this week, and I loved it because I'm a father of four daughters. It says this, guys, all right, guys, I want you to close your eyes. Imagine you have a daughter. That's really hard for me. Now imagine she's dating a guy just like you. Did you smile? No? Then change. Loved it. Loved it. Because when you think about what we're getting at here, what God is also saying is, you are my answer to the prayer. It's just going to mean you have to change. We've seen this during this week in the flooding, by the way. We could sit there, we could have sat there and said, oh my gosh, the people over in Elm Grove, they've taken on a lot of water. Thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers. Hey, I'm all for thoughts and prayers. Please hear what I'm saying. But at some point, you got to get the shovel and get the job done. And the word that's involved there, friends, is sacrifice. That's it. So if you want deep spiritual change, guess where it starts? Deep spiritual change starts in you. And then it flows out of you. God's first task for Gideon, get the idols out of your home. God's first task for you, get the idols out of your home. Get them out. Private worship prepares us for public power from God. Did you hear what I said? Private worship prepares us for public power from God. There are no shortcuts in your spiritual life. For Gideon, the issue wasn't that he wasn't worshiping God. Did you notice he's talking to him? It wasn't that he was worshiping God. It's that he was worshiping God and something else. And that's just like us. That's idolatry. That's idolatry. Here's the evidence. The gods they worshiped in addition to God, they were the things pointed out here, they're the things that provide this guarantee of rain. We're probably not that thrilled with that this week, but you get the idea. We need rain for the crops. Got it. We have a God for that. Fertility, and thus you get heritage. We have a God for that. Did you notice they're talking about poles that are erected to gods in their homes so that it'll meet a need, apparently a need that God won't meet. So they're sitting there going, I've got God, and I've got gods. That's idolatry. Here's more evidence. It usually requires us to give up at least part of our relationship with God so that we can have what we think it provides. All of these other idols that we have, think about it. It usually requires us to give up at least part of our relationship with God so that we can have what we think that God is going to provide for us. And we think the exchange is a good one. We'll take it because I want its benefits. And this is where courage comes in, because what you saw was Gideon struggled just a tad with courage. Is that fair? Remember that courage is the ability to do something that frightens you. It is totally fine for Gideon to be like, those people are scary. They've been vicious. Nowhere in this did God say, oh, and I want you to be oblivious to the Midianites. I want you to be oblivious to all the torture that people have been. Did it ever say that? What he said is, I'm with you. And they're going to be delivered. Courage the ability to do something that frightens you. Gideon's question was, how do I know that you're with me? And this is what we see in all this narrative in chapter 6. God is really patient with him. Really patient. And even Gideon knows this. In verse 39, if you paid attention, he asks God not to be angry at him for asking again. But I'm reminded of something. Jesus in Gethsemane, he's looking his suffering in the face. He knows that it's going to be intense. But what does he do? Three times in the garden, he prays to his Father. Three times. And what does he do? Three times he prays the same thing. It is perfectly fine for us to keep taking our heart back to our Father. Perfectly fine. What isn't perfectly fine is taking disobedience to our Father, or half of a heart to our Father. This is what I want you to see that you have. What it is that you can have in Jesus. This is what I want you to see. In Jesus, you can have a love that can never be fathomed. A life that can never die. A righteousness that can never be tarnished. A peace that can never be understood. A rest that can never be disturbed. A joy that can never be diminished. A hope that can never be disappointed. A glory that can never be clouded. A light that can never be darkened. A purity that can never be defiled. A beauty that can never be marred, a wisdom that can never be baffled, resources that can never be exhausted. That's what God says you get when he says, I'm with you. I'm with you. For some of us, here's the thing, and this is kind of the story of the cross. When you look at the Bible, the way that it describes it, and it talks about our condition is one of sin, but it says the wages of sin is death. And I want you to think about this. What you have in the story of the cross is that death has been addressed. If the wages of sin is death, Jesus dies. But the free gift of God is eternal life. And I want you to picture it. I want you to picture it like this in your mind's eye, because this, I think, is where actually a lot of people might be sitting this morning. It's a debt that has been paid. It's just that we haven't chosen to accept the payment. You get it? It's a debt that has been paid. It's that we have not chosen to accept the payment. And what that means is that the work of Christ on the cross is not applied to you. It's a gift that's been offered, but the gift has to be opened. What I want us to ask this morning, very simple question. Have you been worshiping God the way that maybe Gideon and some of the people in Judges chapter 6 were worshiping God? Here's why I'm asking this. Were you pursuing his benefits, or did you just want God? Are you pursuing his benefits, or did you just want him? I'm not saying that there aren't benefits. There are clearly benefits. They've been pointed out, right? But the pursuit of him, I just want a relationship with him. So years ago, when I was getting married, this was the thing, and it's considered like a great transaction, right? Marriage is more than a transaction, but hang in there, right? It's like the great transaction. Everything that was mine became Wendy's. Everything that was mine became hers. This is the great transaction with Jesus. Everything that is his becomes yours. We just have to take the relationship. My question is, are you ready for that and for everything that it means? So I just want to spend a time, just a minute, in prayer this morning. Remove your distractions. I know that there are a lot. I know there are a lot of them. It's been a crazy week. I get it. I get it. But if you could just bow your head for a moment. Just give a little bit of time to the Lord and think with me on some of these things. And I want you to answer just a couple of questions this morning. What is the thing in your life, what is the fear in your life that is keeping you from following Jesus? What is the fear in your life that is keeping you from following Jesus? What is that thing? Might be a call that he has put on your life, but you see the circumstances surrounding it, and you think that the sacrifice is too great. And as a result, you don't see Jesus as worth following. What is that? And can I ask you this morning to put it at his feet and to know that the greatest blessing is just in following him. And the same thing that he demonstrates on the cross is the same word that God gave to Gideon. I'm with you. Well, what else do you need? I'm with you. What is it? Second question I want you to think about this morning and throughout the week. Has the worship that you've been offering Jesus really been worship? Or have you just been wanting his stuff? The stuff is what comes with Jesus, don't get me wrong. But worship is actually from an abundance and an overflow of a thankful heart for what you know that Jesus has already done. Sometimes I think that we're a little bit more like Gideon and that we look at God and we say, why don't you do great stuff for me like you did for everybody else? And it comes at a great expense because we don't see all the great things that he's doing for us right now. God is good. Take just a minute and pray. We're going to sing. After we dismiss, here's what I encourage you to do. I encourage you to find a staff member. Maybe you need us to pray with you. Maybe you need us to walk alongside you. It's what we want to do. Maybe you just need to come to the rails and you need to leave something here before you walk out of this place. Hand it to Jesus. That's what this time is about. For some of you, it's as simple as this: following in obedience in something like baptism. I don't want to do it. I'm too scared. People are going to see me. Give it to Jesus. Whatever it may be, give it to Jesus.